For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, your usual customary troglodytes, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell,
good morning.
Mr. Mark Tuttle, and recently we've had a Supreme Court justice nominated, confirmed, and sworn in, and so we're going to take a look at the systems of judicial choice and how we look at the courts. And so to do that, we knew that was over our heads.
Right. You bet it is.
So we went to our resident expert, and we have with us Judge Scott Cirque.
Thank you. Thank you.
Great to have you back in the cave.
Glad to be here.
All right. Yeah, a lot has happened since we've had you in the cave. And where should we start, Mark?
Well, the courts have been in the news. And as our listeners know, the way the cave is set up is we try to get beneath the headlines a little bit. We kind of try to look at the philosophical principles, sort of those eternal truths that exist that don't fluctuate but are sitting there behind the headlines and between the lines of what we're reading in the newspapers or hearing on the radio. And so as the courts have become topical, there's been discussion of adding Supreme Court justices. There's been discussion of what roles the courts are playing or possibly could play in the upcoming election. So we thought we would dive in a little bit and try to just get into some legal theory, just some ideas of why we even have a judiciary. Why do we have a courts? Why do there originally you go back historically. You had kings. They kind of grew and evolved into an administrative executive branch of a government. You had parliaments. They came from king's advisors, and then they eventually became the legislative branch. This idea of a separate court system that was outside the two of those, that's a little bit of a new development historically. And, the question of why we have it, why do we even need somebody to sort of look at the laws independently rather than those people that wrote them or those people that are executing them and putting them into place? I think that's a fundamental question we should start with.
Yes, and I think actually Justice Barrett now, in her confirmation hearings, addressed that well, and in her comments about it, in saying that policy preferences is huge for United States senators. It's not for judges. She stressed several times what Justice Scalia said. A good judge should be disappointed in the policy outcomes of the decisions he or she make many times, because you base it on the rule of law, and that's your priority. So we don't want the Supreme Court to become a super legislature. The Supreme Court should apply its judicial philosophy and the law and the Constitution and follow the rule of law. So it's separate and distinct. That's why they're not subject to elections now, and they are there for life. Their role is to be independent but apply the law and the Constitution.
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize or have forgotten that the kind of the original system that was set up by the Constitution before it was changed with amendments, so it's still constitutional because it's based on amendments, was even further removed. The whole process of nominating and confirming Supreme Court justices was even further removed from popular votes because the Senate was appointed. So the Senate was appointed by the states originally. It would have been the governor or legislatures within a state that selected and appointed somebody to be the Senate. So you had a president. The president has always been elected, but then the Senate confirmation process was one step removed from politics as well.
That is accurate. That's a very good point. The state legislature selected your senators. It wasn't the popular vote of the people. So, and that that was to try and lessen the hot partisan issues, mm-hmm. and that we have a branch of government that is to try and decide based on the rule of law and what Congress meant, what the Constitution meant at the time.
I'm kind of drawn back to sacred scripture in the Old Testament is kind of where I tend to, on this topic, I tend to begin with in terms of thinking about the law and judges. And I think of, in the Old Testament, you know, where Moses is given the law, God's law, right, in the form of the Ten Commandments. And what happens almost immediately? Well, people disagree on how to apply it, right? And so that seems, and I'm going to say that's sort of the effect of original sin, where we know original sin darkens the intellect and weakens the will. And so reasonable people can disagree, and they have disputes. And so when you have a dispute with, say, let's just say your neighbor, you know, going back, say, 2,000-3,000 years, what happens is you can resolve those disputes with force and engage in, say, things like vengeance, retaliation. But instead, societies, and this happens in Greece as well, you have what? The societies are then, rather than having that retaliation or vengeance as the way to resolve disputes, you instead form laws that sit outside the individual's preferences, and then your society is then ruled by law, but you need someone to sort of, you need someone then to apply the law and adjudicate these things, right? And so that's how I see it sort of begin. We even have in the Old Testament, we have books called Judges, right? And so you begin to see how God begins to institute this system of laws and judges to achieve justice. I also think another fair analogy, contemporary setting, is that this comes up sometimes too, and it's a parallel to, say, even the magisterium, as well as the court system, is why do we have, like, why are there umpires in when we play baseball, right? Why can't we just, if we had two baseball teams, the rules are not that complicated, right? Why couldn't we just issue everyone the rules of the game of baseball, all the players, and just let the two teams have at it? Why do you need an umpire? Well, again, you need someone who's kind of impartial to call balls and strikes. Right. This is inbounds, this is out of bounds, and sort of apply and enforce, for the sense of justice and fairness, the rules of the game, because the players themselves can be caught up, let's say, in the heat of the moment and make bad decisions, right? Or self-serving decisions, right, that violate the rules. So by having an umpire, you actually play the game better. It's a better game when you have an umpire there. And I think that's when you're trying to achieve justice as a society, it's a better society when you have a good judicial system.
That's an excellent point. I mean, so many of those points I just agree with are just well said. What a judge's role to do is to be totally impartial and decide it based on the rule of law. Not that somebody is wealthier, not that somebody is stronger.
Maybe aligns with your worldview. I mean, how hard is it to apply a law that you personally disagree with?
Well, it's
right, because not every law is going to line up with what you personally think is the best kind of law, right? Yeah. There, I mean, the legalization of abortion is, right, not that you have to apply it in your role, but I mean, that's an unjust law, but you have to, right, as a judge, though, you're going to have to follow it.
Well, and that's the type of justice Justice Barrett will be, or what she said, and what she said in her, when you look at her speeches that she's done. She has a recent speech at Hillsdale College, Notre Dame Law School.
I saw that one. Yeah, and that was really good.
They're very good. But she even says on those, and she has to follow the law. And I think, you know, she said there may be decisions that will come through that she doesn't like. You know, on the, you know, President Trump and the Republicans could be surprised by some of the decisions she's going to make, mm-hmm. but she is going to follow the law, like Justice Scalia did as well. So that's an important aspect of being a judge. The other is great moral character, and I think mm-hmm. that's exhibited. You've got to be independent of those things and make those decisions.
Now, Tim, when you were talking, you were kind of talking about sort of the origins of law with the Ten Commandments, and you know,
one example. It's not the only one.
Well, of course. Yeah. But a little bit later in history, you know, that role of being that impartial umpire, that impartial judge, it fell to the church. So in the Middle Ages, you had laws, and most of the laws, quite honestly, were canon law. You know, the system of law that prevailed was canon law, and then you had kings that they were supposed to be, you know, executing those laws and making sure that those laws were being enforced, etc. Now we've got an independent judiciary that's separate from religion. You know, and the country was founded on the idea that religion and the government are two separate entities, church and state. You know, there needs to be, I mean, well, it's not in the written constitution, but definitely in our de facto constitution at this point, there's a separation between church and state. Where is that boundary, though? Because, you know, when you are enforcing, when you're deciding where the law follows, it's not completely, you're not keeping morality out of it. There's certainly moral choices and moral decision making that goes into adjudicating the law.
This takes me back to John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, their differing views. The separation of church and state was, in a letter of Jefferson's that was later picked up in a Supreme Court opinion. And that kind of goes with how Jefferson took things. But John Adams stressed the importance that this government that was created depended on a moral, religious people. Not saying what they were trying to do is not saying we're not going to have a Church of England here in the United States, but they encourage people to have their own faith and morals. So I think we're dependent on having those morals and applying it, particularly if you're going to have an independent judiciary. If you have a judiciary that's just going to go with the power, that's going to be a grave danger for all of us.
And that goes two, three, fourfold for the judiciary itself, for our judges, that, you know, you have to have a judiciary and judges that are of strong moral character.
You absolutely have to. That is the priority. We follow the rules of judicial conduct here, I'm going to draw Article 2, Rule 4, Subsection D, a judge is not to express partisan views. So I always am conscious that I review that before I come here. But you all have them, but you and the role of a judge, you have to separate that out, and you have to act in the best interest of all people so that all people know it's as fair as possible. And I think that's really what Amy Coney Barrett said consistently in her testimony and throughout, is that she's going to decide it based on the law and not her policy preferences.
And with that, we're going to take a break. We'll be back with Judge Scott Cirk looking at judicial philosophy on The Catholic Cave here on Catholic Radio Indy.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor. Tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm still Timothy O'Donnell. In the cave is Mark Tuttle, our trusty sidekick, Kent Blanford, but also an honorary caveman himself, Judge Scott Cirk.
I can see his hairy knuckles from here.
Right, exactly, right. And your wardrobe is uncannily familiar. It looks like a Fred Flintstone kind of getup. But anyway, we're talking about judicial philosophy, and obviously with the I don't know, what would we call it, installation of Justice Amy Coney Barrett?
Confirmation.
Confirmation. Yeah, she's the... So a lot led up to that. And so this is a good opportunity for us to kind of understand a little bit about the roles of the, why we even have a judiciary, why it's important. One of the things that I think one of the sticking points that that came up, or points of contention in the confirmation hearings, was the idea of originalism as a judicial philosophy. And so I'm wondering, Judge, if you could tell us a little bit about what is originalism and what's meant by that term, and then maybe we'll speculate a little bit about why it would be contentious.
Yes, I'll do my best to explain. I am going to say I did see on YouTube Judge Barrett, Justice Barrett, talk about it on a segment from March 28, 2019 at Notre Dame, and she did a superb job. I'll try and do my best with that, but what she's saying by it, what Justice Scalia means by it, and what it is, it's a judicial philosophy where you go back to what either Congress said when they passed the law or what the Constitution meant at the time, and you go back to the original meaning and you use that as your starting point, and then you lay out how you apply that to this particular case. So you show your work and you apply it to the situations that they're applying the meaning and how it applies in this case and why you need to make the decision you need to make. I guess that's how I'd simply say it. But I'd also say I like judges who have a judicial philosophy. Some judges insist on no philosophy. If you have no philosophy, that's your philosophy. Mm-hmm. But if your philosophy is originalism, then you go, it's kind of like your plan for life. If you have no plan for life, it ain't a very good plan, but that's your plan.
Right. You know what I say about that is, you know, if you go with, you know what goes, I bring something in class sometimes, I say, you know what goes with the flow? Oh, you like to go with the, yeah, a dead body in a river.
That's okay? Exactly right.
That's if you want your life to be like a dead body in a river, just go with the flow.
And that's the same thing. That's the same thing you're getting with.
Said like a true guy from Chicago.
Right. But can't remember it.
That's the same thing you're getting with the judicial philosophy. Justice Barrett has a philosophy. She's going to apply that. And she said she's not going to be a super legislator. She's going to be different than senators. She's going to make her decisions based on the original meaning and the law.
And this creates a little bit of a dance with the legislatures, right? Because, you know, the more debate you have back and forth, the more discussion you have as the legislation's being, you know, created, the more understanding of what legislative intent is there around these laws. So, you know, you've got a whole body that's really outside the written work of the law itself that you can then look at to say, okay, is this really what the legislators meant, or is this what the legislators meant? Well, okay, they had a debate here. So there's sort of this dance then that goes on of the sausage-making process of creating this legislation, leaving enough evidence of what the legislators really meant for a judge to come back and say, okay, yeah, this was the legislative intent of the law.
Yes, I think that's a very good point. That's what originalists would look at to make their decision. However, the sad thing and why we, even in our lifetimes, we put more emphasis on the Supreme Court is because legislatures don't want to do their job. They don't want to take the political heat. And that's a good example with the Affordable Care Act. Politically, it was being said, this is not a tax. Chief Justice Roberts, to keep that in place, said, well, even though you're saying it's not a tax, the only constitutional authority is it's a tax. Well, that goes to kind of the failure in our politics,
right? And you know, the Affordable Care Act is another good example too of, you had this massive piece of legislation where there were entire chapters of it that weren't able to be discussed on the floor of Congress. So and a lot of it was negotiated and decided kind of behind closed doors, outside the view of the public. So you had very little, in a lot of ways, legislative record to go back and look at and kind of say, okay, you know, in chapter 156, I have no idea how many chapters there are to this law, but in chapter 156, you know, this is what they meant. Well, there's no discussion of that because it was either done in a closed meeting or it was just completely not even discussed, and we had to pass it before we knew what was in the law.
You're quoting someone there.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think that's one of the dangers. Going back to what you said, Judge, one of the dangers is in this balance of power that we have between the executive, the legislative, and judicial branches, that the legislature can do a couple of things that I think are precarious for a democracy or a republic. One is when they're in a majority, they can, because of the raw power that offers them, they can forego, say, debate that ought to happen across the aisle to try to improve the legislation to create maybe more consensus. Because if they have the votes to get it done, that can be seen as, hey, I don't really need to do that. So you lose an opportunity for not just consensus building and improvement of, say, the pending legislation, but you also miss an opportunity to bring the American people along with you, right? So that's number one. And number two is when you find yourself in a minority position opposing certain laws, there's this temptation, the strategy that we've seen. And I think Roe v. Wade is a classic example. And you tell me if I'm wrong, where when there are people in the country who want to affect change in laws, and rather than going through the hard work of convincing legislatures, much less Congress and a president, they, like you said, become super. They use the courts by picking a hard case that can generate a lot of sympathy, and then in one fell swoop, you can strike down or change the law of the whole land. That sort of strategy to me has a certain kind of glamour and allure to it, right? We saw it also with what? Same-sex marriage. That was another example where state legislatures had, by and large, moved in that direction. I forget before that Supreme Court. I mean, there's probably 20, 30 states that already legalized it, and it was headed in that direction for the rest, for the most part. But there was a successful effort made to use the Supreme Court to overnight change the law of the land. Same thing happened with Roe v. Wade, I think.
That is an excellent point. And I guess that is an excellent point. In both those cases, that's what's done, as opposed to getting the political power and convincing people in the legislature in the process it was meant to. It went around and to the courts. And that's not the best way to use the courts, and the courts should... If you have a originalist policy, it's less likely for that to happen if the judges do. But both those examples are perfect, right on point.
Now, has the understanding of how a judge is bound by precedent, has that changed over time? Because it seems to me like it used to be that if you had a precedent, it would inform judges' decisions in future years as it came up, but it wouldn't necessarily dictate it. You know, a judge seemed to have a lot of latitude of kind of deciding and kind of challenging the courts above him a little bit, and that seems like that's kind of gone by the wayside a little bit.
The precedent is still very, very powerful. In fact, again, Judge Barrett stressed that there is precedent there. She did go into a little distinction of super precedent, like Brown versus the Board of Education, saying that was definitely something that total consensus, not only by the law and policy, supports that. And then some cases are not. They can be looked at. Supreme Court cases are badly cited. In fact, this is something that Justice Barrett pointed out that's important for her and a role model, the case where the Supreme Court affirmed the Japanese internment camps during World War II.
Mm, right.
She focused as her hero in that, Justice Robert Jackson. He was an FDR friend. He was appointed Solicitor General, Attorney General, and Supreme Court Justice by FDR. But he went against the majority opinion and dissented, and he was right. That was a mark on America, and it was improperly constitutionally decided. It was done by the court, again, being similar to what Tim said earlier, being used by the political pressures of the time, and Justice Jackson said that was wrong. So There are poorly decided cases that should be overturned, such as that, such as Dred Scott. Mm-hmm. That's a great example where a great book I'd recommend to both of you, Lincoln and Taney. I can't remember the author's name, but he goes into that relationship. Chief Justice Taney had had personal tragedy before that. His wife and daughter had died. He saw the Civil War coming. He wanted to solve the Civil War. He went outside judicial. He poorly decided Dred Scott to do a political decision, and it was a disaster. So, judges need to follow their role, and it'd be better if legislators followed theirs. That's why Americans need to stand up and say, we need better political leadership.
Right. That sounds to me also like maybe the from a moral philosophy standpoint, the failure there is to fall into the trap of the end justifies the means.
Excellent.
Yeah. Right. So he chose the wrong. Maybe he had a good end. He wants to avoid the Civil War, let's say, but he chose the wrong way to do it by abandoning, say, his judicial commitments in order to bring about what he saw as a laudable end.
A judge I serve with in Hancock County, Judge Marshall, always says, stay in your lanes.
Stay in your lanes. Yeah, right, right.
Particularly for judges.
And I need the bumpers, too.
I do, too. but even great men and women, sometimes they want to do... judge, you just, if you want to affect policy, like the attorneys in Roe v. Wade that started it, they should have ran for the legislature.
Well, I love Dostoevsky, and that was the one quote was, right, the great temptation is to kill one innocent life in order to achieve something great.
Yeah.
You know, that's the one temptation.
He speaks the truth, doesn't
he? Yeah, I love Dostoevsky.
Yeah. We need to take a break. And we'll be back with more of the Catholic Cave right after this.
Ever since we've been on the air at Catholic Radio, we've always wanted to have billboards, but they just don't fit in our budget. And since you'll probably never see a real billboard for us, I'm going to ask you to do something, to imagine one. In your mind, picture a large, empty billboard. Yeah, that's it. Now pick a background color, any color at all. Okay, then across the top of your billboard, put just two words, Catholic Radio. Make them really big. Then below that in even bigger letters, put 89.1 and 90.9 FM. Wow, that's a great billboard. Now, if this billboard were real, all of your friends and neighbors could see it, and they'd know all about Catholic Radio. But since it's only an imaginary billboard, we're going to have to depend on you to tell your friends about Catholic Radio. Remember, Catholic Radio 89.1 and 90.9 FM. Oh, and by the way, nice choice on that background color. It really looks good.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell, Kent Blanford, and we have special guest Judge Scott Cirk with us. And we are talking about courts. We're talking about judicial philosophy. And as we're coming close to an election, people get a little bit nervous when it's a tight election and the polls are tightening up and it's looking like there might be some questions, because then the question is this going to get thrown to the courts? And so why is that such a scary proposition to so many people, that this might be thrown to the courts? And the courts, do they actually decide the election, or what's really their role there?
No, their role is to apply the law to the situation that's before it. And, you know, we recently had that experience with Bush v. Gore, and that's what we want to avoid, because people look at it and say, well, that's wrongly decided on the issue that the court majority decided that way. But in all cases, we want our elections decided by the people, who that's their responsibility. We get the government that we deserve, that we elect, and that's how it needs to be decided. We don't want anybody to be influenced or to influence in their own way, particularly judges.
Now, as you mentioned, you know, there's a name to that. It was Bush v. Gore. This was actually a suit that was filed.
Yeah.
And so it's not like, you know, there's a close election and then the courts are going to go and they're going to decide who won or lost. There has to be a suit filed by a plaintiff against somebody else who's a defendant about a particular question of the law.
Excellent. Yeah.
Yeah. What was in dispute with that, in case people don't know or remember?
Yeah.
The hanging Chad.
Yes. Yeah. Vice President Gore wanted to keep voting, to bring in more votes. Bush had actually won on the tally by a small amount, I think like 538 votes. And then the Florida Supreme Court was ruling in favor of Vice President Gore and their view of it. And then we got appealed to the Supreme Court, who decided based on equal protection, the case had been decided, or the election was decided and it was done, counting was done. And a lot of people who lost that still are angry about it. I mean, no criticism of Vice President Gore. It was an extremely close election. But the other extremely close election, roughly in our lifetime, and just slightly before my life, but the last election before I was born was 1960. Mm. And several people went to Vice President Nixon and said, Illinois, there was improper voting, and you can see it. And what was
you mean
done
in Chicago in with Mayor Daley?
Yes,
with the boss
there was running the polls. Improper voting in Chicago
by the Daleys.
But Vice President Nixon's
wild accusation
response to that was it would be detrimental to America, and I'm not going to challenge the election. So both he and Vice President Gore made different decisions, and. You know, you can argue that, but yeah.
And the judicial system had really no option to intervene in that 1960 election. There had to be one of the candidates had to file a suit for the courts to be able to play a role.
And he refused to do so. So, yeah.
Why would, I'll turn the conversation just a little bit. If someone's out there listening, Judge, why would someone, maybe a younger person who's maybe considering law school and then maybe potentially becoming a judge themselves, what might be some of the reasons why someone might follow in your footsteps?
Well, I think it's primarily, when you mentioned the umpire, that's ultimately a simple way to say what a judge is, but a judge is so concerned about the validity of the system, that the system is fair to everyone, not that the Democrats win or the Republicans win or even in a particular case, but that everyone has that equal right. And that's why ultimately you want to be a judge or an umpire. You care about the game or the law, and you want to make sure it's applied equally to the poorest person, the poor widow from scripture,
right?
Or to you know,
the wealthiest, most powerful.
The wealthiest, you know, Donald Trump or Joe Biden. You want it applied equally to all. And that's why you'd want to go into the law. And so, and then the law is just to, is also to ensure everything is fair. And that's where it comes in, contracts and like that. If you love opera, like Justice Scalia, he pointed that out. Lawyers are important to opera in that they get paid well by the contracts or that type of thing. It's a side way, but they are involved. So that's, we just want to ensure, I guess, ensure fairness to all and not your own personal preferences. That you can't do that as a judge.
Yeah, what about I want to maybe pick up something else we were talking about earlier. We were talking a little bit about the separation of church and state, and that comes up quite a bit, right? The don't impose your religion on me, that kind of stuff in laws and things like that. I don't want to pick up that thread, although we could, but a different thread. There are instances in I'm going to go here to like the Soviet Union, for example, where there wasn't a separation of church and state because it really, there was no church, right? They suppressed it. But the state basically controlled the courts. And then you had kind of these show trials and things like that. What if any, do you see as any particular, do you see any particular threats? And you talk about the system overall, the court system, the judicial branch of government. Are there any contemporary threats to the impartiality, the fairness that you were just talking about? Do you see threats out there?
I don't see a real viable threat of that right now, but liberty and our system of justice is something you have to always be vigilant for, and it's always possible. So we always have to be aware of that and ensure it doesn't happen. If you know, if, for instance, one side would just control everything, the presidency, the Senate, the House.
Like a supermajority.
Like a supermajority.
Mm-hmm. And ramrod stuff through.
Still, we, the minority, we need to be protected, or whoever would be, and, you know, defend that. It's just like the Little Sisters of the Poor stood up to the challenges of the previous administration and prevailed through the court system.
Great
and that
example.
It is fair, yeah. So I think that's something that we want to be cognizant of.
Now, how aware and how much of an effect does, I think, trends and things that are going on within society affect a judge's decision making? You know, the textbook definition of injustice is a judge wrongly condemning an innocent man because he wants to avoid a riot. You know, he wants to avoid mm-hmm. something going on that's bad, that, you know, kind of, okay, for the sake of the many, I'm going to sacrifice what's good for the individual or for the few.
Yeah. Trends
wasn't
are...
Wasn't that the end of Wrath of Khan?
Yeah.
I mean, that was
yeah.
Spock. Right? That was one of the best. I love that
that's
movie.
That's a great movie.
There were a lot of bad Star Trek movies, but that was a good one.
That yeah. was a great one, yes. And that's a great point. Yeah. And that's
Nanu,
a great...
Nanu. Oh, wait, I'm mixing up my sci-fi. That was Mork for Mork.
Right.
That's excellent. That's a great point. Great point with Wrath of Khan. But, you know, there are trends. Judges are human. They're affected by that. There's certainly a policy or a pull toward that. But again, I think ultimately a judge has to just be cognizant of the trends, but decide the cases based on the law. A quick example I'll give is when I went to quote unquote new judge school, or what we call baby judge school. And it was a great experience. The Supreme Court does a great job in talking about it. But one of our speakers was a nice young lady who was speaking of how the transgender issue. And in that, in the part of her talk, and it was all nice, but part of it, she got questions. And one of the questions was, how do we refer to transgenders? What do we say to them? She says, we prefer to be called they. Mm. Now, I'm sitting there listening to this, and my thought was, you know, they is a plural. It's not a single. It's not a singular reference. And I don't think we should change the language because of that. And I thought the gist of her talk was, just be polite to us. Just be polite. Mm-hmm. And I think if we are just polite, those issues are dealt with. That's my take from it. And sometimes we can go with trends maybe a little too far. I mean, people should be called he or she, what they, you know, but with respect and dignity for how they are. You know, marriage should be what, you know, all issues, like marriage is has a specific meaning, and that should be recognized. But judges should treat all with great respect. I think that's something I would say on that issue.
Yeah, I think that would go a long way, being polite and respectful.
Yes, and always.
Especially with people we disagree with.
Especially.
Right, because I think it behooves all of us to exercise the virtue of, like, intellectual humility. Humility overall, but intellectual humility in this regard, in that, you know, you have to recognize that I might be mistaken. You know what I mean? And now that I'm newly married, I'm reminded that often by yeah. my better half. Tim, you're wrong. You know? Yeah. And so you get, but that's the thing, is that we have to understand that, it, you know, we're fallen and sinful, and I don't possess like the complete inexhaustible truth itself. That's
right.
That's Christ our Lord.
You know? That's exactly right.
Sometimes I come close to that.
But. Right.
In a most humble way.
Right. Then you wake up from your nap after a big lunch and you realize you're just you.
Yeah.
How would you, Judge Sir, how would you... you talked about the importance of impartiality. I think that's one of the hardest things when I work with, in say an educational sphere with younger people, is that to help them become, I think it's Adam Smith called it the impartial spectator, where you're trying to expose someone to great thinkers and thinkers that they don't necessarily agree with, because you want them to see kind of all sides of an issue, and then perform a critical analysis, right, that leads them ideally to the truth of things. How do you train your mind to be to look at things impartially? I mean, what's that sort of inner, okay, so just put you on the spot. What's that sort of inner dialogue that you have to have with yourself, or that you have with yourself when you're trying to approach something that maybe it's a bit of a hot button issue for you personally, but you know, again, as in your role, you put your robes on. I like this saying too, this came out, you know, judges wear black, they don't wear red or blue. How do you train your mind to be impartial when you've got some, say, emotions or other commitments that are pulling you in a different direction?
Follow the law. Always go back to the law first and foremost. Realize that people don't want to be judged according to
your preferences,
Scott,
right?
Sirk or Amy Coney Barrett. My children have suffered through that. No one else needs to do so. So you decide from the law and separate it out, and make sure you do that every time.
And with that, we need to take a break. We'll be back with more of the Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy right after this.
Where do you go for reliable information on what's happening in the world? Where can you turn for rock-solid teaching backed by centuries of unchanging, undeniable truth? Look first to the Catholic Church, and then be sure to tune in right here to Catholic Radio Indy. We are your source for 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Catholic Radio Indy and CatholicRadioIndy.org.
Back when the COVID-19 pandemic first began, the five bishops in Indiana issued a special dispensation temporarily absolving Catholics from their obligation to attend Mass on Sundays and Holy Days. Because of increasing numbers of positive COVID tests and hospitalizations, the bishops are temporarily extending the dispensation until further notice. The Indiana bishops will continue to monitor the situation and determine when it might be advisable to modify or lift the dispensation. All churches will remain open and will have regular or modified Mass schedules following public health guidelines. For the safety of fellow parishioners, if you're coughing, sneezing, have other COVID symptoms, or recent contact with someone who has the virus, you're asked not to attend. If you are healthy, wear a mask, and observe social distancing, your parish would love to see you back in the pews. Keep checking with your parish website or bulletin for updates.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor, tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell, Judge Scott Sirk here, and we were just talking about impartiality and that ability to render judgments in an impartial way. And we've been talking about how, you know, ultimately judges are supposed to be non-political. And yet, we're coming up to an election and all of us are going to be looking at a ballot. Some of us have already looked at and filled out that ballot. And there's going to be a number of judges on it. And some judges are going to be up for election. Some of them are going to be to be retained. What is the political process there of you know, electing and retaining and voting on judges?
Well, it's a difficult aspect. I'm not sure judges like county level, except maybe Marin County. I think Marin County may have an exception to this, but local judges such as myself have elections where the citizens can vote. Higher up, Court of Appeals, Supreme Court in Indiana, it's just whether they're retained or not. And that's basically just to try and lessen the partisan politics. Mm. So I would say that's the reason that's set up that way, is to try and lessen it, because judges are to be totally fair and not, and also not give an indication as how they sway. And that's the difficulty that can arise when, like in local elections like I had, where you have to declare a party and then you can be active candidate during that cycle. But see, like our rules are, the judicial rules for Indiana judges are, you can only be active politically when you're running. You can't, after that, you can't support any candidate one way or the other, show any preference. It's just the year you're running. So It's not a perfect system. It's a hybrid is what I would say.
Now you said you know, in Marion County it may be different. So yeah. These vary county by county.
Marion County did it, and I'm not an expert on this, but in 1974, the Watergate year, they just swept out all of the Republican judges and all the Democratic judges won. And they said they didn't want that to happen again. So they've kind of changed their system not to be as subject to the national whim, so to speak. But
what do you think, since this is our last segment of the show, let's maybe turn towards the future, turn towards the horizon a little bit. What do you think are going to be some of the challenges that might face us going into, say, 2021? I mean, this we're recording just ahead of the presidential election. What do you think, though, might be, when you think of like 2021, 2022, from a judicial standpoint, what do you think might be some of the challenges or things that might be facing us? And it could be from the local level all the way up to the Supreme Court.
Well, from a judicial standpoint, stay in your lane. Mm-hmm. My colleague Judge Marshall's advice is good. Stay in your lane, and the judges decide impartially based on their judicial philosophy and fair, not on the politics. And I just, when you were saying, what do you see going for us forward for 2021, I think it's everybody just do your job. The media should report who, what, when, where, and the facts, and not feel
advocate.
Like, not advocate.
Lobby.
The citizens should, we citizens need to, we want our leaders to be more moral, people that we can respect, that we're proud of. You know, we've come a long way from General Eisenhower, so to speak. So I think we all need, the citizens need to take a more active role, and we all need to do our jobs and not be advocates. Yeah, I think we're getting close to the point, I don't want to get too much on this, but maybe the media has jumped the shark, you know, like Fonzie and Happy Days. And,
right.
And they need to, you know, we're funny all enough, human,
they brought the whole
need to look at, you know.
They brought the whole cast back together of Happy Days, by the way, to do a fundraiser for one of the presidential candidates.
Oh, did they really?
Which one? Yeah. And they went to Milwaukee, which is where the show was set.
Yeah.
So growing up with Happy Days. And I also liked the companion show, Laverne and Shirley, yeah, was also pretty good.
It's fine for citizens to do that, but I do think the media, like judges, need to stay in their lane, and they have a different role in that. And we would all be better served if we did that. So I think going forward, everybody, you have an important job. Just do your job. Don't try to do more than you can or should.
Do you think there's one of the things that has been in the news quite a bit are, you know, say governors as an example, and it varies from state to state, but some states have very restrictive kind of lockdowns and things like that, that the governors seem to, you know, be exercising a certain kind of extraordinary power given the threat, the public health risk. Do you see some of that perhaps getting challenged later on from a personal liberty standpoint? And, you know, I know this is speculation, but in my way of thinking, you know, someone might be fed up with, say, mask mandates, or that their business isn't able to reopen after a long period of time and the health risk seems to have abated. Do you see, like, maybe some activity in the court system because of challenging some of this extraordinary power that some governors have been exercising?
I would say it would be better, as opposed to go right to the courts, go to the legislature first to say, hey, if we have this crisis again, this is how we need to approach it. Crises are a difficult time for governing. The pandemic certainly indicated that. But, you know, like Governor Holcomb, he had the powers to make the decisions that he did, subject to legislature approval. Some of our neighboring states, Michigan, Illinois, were much more restrictive than Indiana. Mm-hmm. So, but that's local. And I think a good general rule for for judges, politicians, as much as possible. G.K. Chesterton stressed this: keep it as local as possible.
Yeah, subsidiarity. Yeah,
politicians should be close enough that you can hit them. That type of
thing. Good point. Yeah. Well, you can pat them on the back, or
pat them in the back,
or something else.
Right. Yep. So you mentioned subsidiarity. You know, how does the Catholic social teaching, the principles of social justice, or I guess principles of justice, as the church teaches it, how do those come into play within, you know, judicial decision making?
Well, I think that the general rules the church have given us has affected everything, the law and everything, and it does come into play whether you're Catholic or not. If you're applying those rules and you're trying to follow the rule, I think that's where I would put that in. And how you need to approach that.
Right, because those, you know, those teachings don't come out of, not directly out of Revelation.
Right.
You know, we've got the revealed truth in the Bible, but then these are part of sort of natural law. These are part of the reasoning process that we all have as human beings. So, yeah, they're not just necessarily the possession of the Catholic Church,
right,
or even Christianity itself.
Right, excellent. That's an excellent point.
Well, we're going to run out of time before we know it. There's just a few minutes left. Let me ask you, Judge Sirk, when we think about the role of the judiciary, say here in the state of Indiana, are there, again, kind of thinking forward, are there any types of, say controversies that you think might come up in the next year or so? I know Indiana, for example, is we've enacted a lot of very, I would say, helpful pro-life laws, some religious liberty laws. Do you see anything on the horizon that really kind of stands out to you as something that we might see come up next year?
Well, I think maybe addressing how the coronavirus, how we address that and go forward, and that may be something that the legislature will address going forward. There's always going to be controversies. That's just the nature of
right.
And
disputes.
And there's
right.
Huge controversies for our country going forward, but and the state. But I think if we go to our basics, if we return to our basics, if we follow the rule of law, we'll get through it just fine.
What do you think? I know a lot of people can kind of throw their hands up in the air. You know, again, we're getting ready for elections, and just say, "Well, this is just such a mess. I'm just going to sit things out." What do you think of that approach?
I wouldn't advise it, but I can understand it.
Right.
A lot of us feel that way at different times, but it can always get better. I think that's one of the great gifts of being Catholic. The whole history of the church. No matter, there have been times worse than these that great saints have come forward and risen up. You have a picture of Saint Maximilian Kolbe up here on the wall in the midst of Auschwitz, what he did and what he rose up. I mean, those are great things.
Yeah, I think that often, in fact, it was brought up, we were talking a little bit on our last program with Dr. David Deevil, the people who tended to stand up most fearlessly to evil totalitarian oppression and violence were people of faith.
Yeah.
And so I think that just underscores, you're a man of great faith, underscores the importance of being Catholic and practicing our faith and taking our faith commitment seriously, because that can give us the grace, the fortitude, the wisdom to prevail when things are difficult. And inevitably, we all face adversity.
We all face adversity. That's well said.
And with that, I want to wrap it up. Just for those of you who are listening to this show on Saturday and Sunday, remember, the election is Tuesday. If you're listening to this show on Tuesday, by the time the show ends, if you haven't voted, you still have 5 hours to get in line. And if you're in line, even if you're in line at 6 o'clock, you're still going to be able to vote. Inform your conscience. Inform what you need to make these decisions about, and get out and vote. For Timothy O'Donnell, for Mark Tuttle, for Judge Scott Sirk, I'm Kent Blandford. vote, and be holy.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400.
Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at catholicradioindy.org.